podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to another mini pod of Tennis Unfiltered with me, James Gray of iNews.co.uk, and a slightly jet lagged Calvin Betton. I think slightly might be an understatement given what I've been hearing of sleep schedule. Calvin, how are you feeling?
I'm all right for the time being, but it was a bit. I mean, I actually don't know how long I was up for. What with the time. Time differences and what have you. I know that the journey was 24 hours plus 3 hours train from the airport. And then I was up from like 8 that morning and we flew at 9. So God knows how long I was. I just think maybe 36 hours I was up for, I think.
Okay. And you've had some sleep, but the old circadian rhythms might take a while.
Yeah, I mean, I went to sleep pretty much, just got in and just like dumped my bags and like just couldn't even bring myself to shower and whatever. Just literally dumped my bags, went on my bed and fell asleep, and then woke up again at about 11 o'clock last night for about an hour, and then I think woke up again at about 3, 4 o'clock this morning.
It's not too bad. 4 a.m. not bad for an opening bid, I would suggest.
Yeah, it was weird, you know. You know, it was strange because I was just laying in bed thinking like, you know, I was listening to a couple of podcasts and was wide awake at that stage. I thought, could do what, you know, might watch something on telly, but nothing on. It didn't click that the tennis was on in the middle of the night here. I was thinking that it's like, I'm going to be getting up at like 11 and the tennis will be on then, you know. But so I did it. I wish I could have watched more of Medvedev and Hurkacz. I ended up watching the fourth and fifth sets, but I was awake for the whole of it and just wasn't watching it.
Well, let's start with Medvedev and Hurkacz then. Medvedev reaching his 8th major semi-final with a 5-set win. Probably didn't expect it to go 5, although Hurkacz has got a pretty good record against Medvedev, Calvin. I wonder how you saw those last two sets.
Yeah, I mean, they played out a lot like a lot of Hurkacz matches do, where he looks great, plays really well. He can look a really great player. Like just in terms of the aesthetic of how he plays, like, you know, he's aggressive, play all court, that kind of thing, but just doesn't really get it over the line against the top players, does he, often enough?
Do you think that's just like a lack of a real killer weapon? He's obviously got a big serve and you know, good rally resistance, but it feels like he can't kill matches off particularly.
I don't think it's his shots particularly. I think he's just, I don't entirely buy into this idea that if you're a nice person, you can't be a great sports person, but he does seem like a really good guy. And I think I think he's one of those as well that, like, it wouldn't surprise me if he does get a few wins if he just starts having the belief that he can do it. But he does get to that stage, and I say this a lot, like, that, you know, choking is when you're living somewhere between fear and hope. He does come into that category a lot where he hits a lot of shots where it looks like he's hoping they go in, rather than that he's certain they're going in. Kind of the opposite from Zverev, who we just watched, who most of his shots, other than his backhand and his serve, are pretty gunk, but he thoroughly believes that they're brilliant, and so he makes some of them in key moments.
On the other side of the net, Daniil Medvedev has been through 2 5-setters now. He also played 4 sets against your mate Nuno Borges, and 3 and a bit sets against Terence Atamon in the first round. Did you see, I mean, he said he felt pretty knackered. Did you see any signs that he might be starting to run out of puff?
It's tough to tell, isn't it? Because he always looks knackered, doesn't he? He hardly looks like he's... It actually struck me, you know, I was watching some of that match in the middle of the night. It struck me that I don't think there's any player that's... I think Daniil Medvedev's a completely unique player in the history of the game in terms of how he plays and his physical stature and what have you. But with that in mind, what we just discussed there, I had a thought that probably the player who I think he's closest to, and this is not me saying that they are close because there's a lot of differences, but I think the player that I would say he's most similar to in recent times is probably Andy Murray, in the just the way that like Murray always had, you know, for a player whose game was making a lot of balls, Murray was quite a big guy. I think he's like 6'3" or 6'4", I think. And he always had a big first serve, like a big flat first serve. His second serve was a bit average. But, you know, he made a lot of balls. And found ways of putting his opponents in awkward positions, and similarly struggled with putting away mid-court balls. He was never that good, Evan. And I think in that respect, then, in that they're both tall, both make a lot of balls, both get a lot of balls back, both have good first serves, both struggle to put away mid-court balls. That those two are pretty, that's where, you know, those Murray and Medvedev, I think, are pretty similar in that respect. There are differences beyond that. Murray's a much better volleyer. He has much more variation in his game than Medvedev does.
Do you think then, I mean, there are other similarities in terms of results. Medvedev's made 5 Grand Slam finals and only won 1, which, you know, Murray obviously made 5 and didn't win any to begin with. Do you think they might end up with quite similar looking careers by the end of it?
Yeah, I think they probably will. I think that Medvedev will probably end up with 3, maybe. Although I'm not entirely convinced that, as you know, me and George have discussed, I'm not entirely convinced that he'll win any more. He might do, but I think it'll be around about 3 if he does. I think he'll probably end up having a similar career to Murray. I think Murray will have been a better player than Medvedev. Mm. But I think that, you know, because Medvedev really has to contest with Djokovic. And Djokovic passed his prime, as much as brilliant as he still is, an up-and-coming up-and-coming Alcaraz. But Murray had to compete with, in their prime, Federer, Nadal, Djokovic, plus in their prime, Wawrinka, Del Potro as well.
Mm. Medvedev is going to play Alexander Zverev in the semifinals on Friday after he beat Carlos Alcaraz in 4 sets, a match that has literally just finished about 10 or 15 minutes ago. Yes, it is nearly 2 a.m. here in Melbourne, which might explain a few things about this podcast. But anyway, Calvin, we were chatting.
I'm surprised, James, being that you mentioned the time there, I'm surprised that adding that extra day 10 days ago didn't affect the time, what time tonight's match finished.
Yes, Craig Tiley's efforts to cancel late nights by adding 1 more day to the tournament made absolutely no difference.
I'm intrigued. Just, we'll come back to the match, James, in a minute. But I'm intrigued as to, because Craig Tiley seems to get a real free ride with the media about everyone loves the Aussie Open, so they constantly praise him. But he seems to get a real free pass with this scheduling thing. Like, I'd seen yesterday that somebody had tweeted that, well, on yesterday's schedule, like, the commentators were blaming everything. They were saying, oh, you know, some of them should have switched courts, et cetera, et cetera. And they came up with all these reasons as to why the matches were running late. And nobody actually blamed Craig Tiley for his obsession with two sessions, getting 2 lots of paying customers in and doing that by starting matches later.
Well, I suppose there's 2 different types of media going on there. I can assure you the print media do not, or the written media do not give him a free ride. But, you know, what you have to remember is broadcasters are actually partly the people in control of these schedules. You know, when those scheduling decisions are made, it is Channel 9 who are in the room saying, actually, we want this or we want that. It's Channel 9 who are saying, well, if we're going to move a match, let's move this one or whatever. So that's probably why they're not that critical of it, because they're actually involved in that decision making. To be quite frank, yeah, it has been hard work this week.
There's no, I've come to the conclusion though, there is no solution to this night match thing. If you're going to have day matches as well, because you can do it like the French do, where it's just they have 1 match, and then if that match is quick, you feel like you've been shortchanged if you're a paying customer, or you can do it like the others do, where it's 2 matches, and if you're going to have a best of five set match. And a best of 3 set match, chances are, and you're going to start at 7 o'clock, which you've kind of got to do if it's a night session. Don't think you can start at 6, really. People are still just leaving work. So you've got to start at 7 o'clock earliest. But if you're going to have 2 tennis matches, one of which is a best of 5 setter, you're probably going to be going pretty late, especially as the tournament goes on and the players are evenly matched.
You're not wrong. I think they had Legends doubles on yesterday at 12 o'clock, which pushed everything back, which meant the night session started 2.5 hours late. That didn't need to happen. I think the other thing about, the 6 o'clock versus 7 o'clock, you can't move the news in Australia, apparently. It's very important. Everyone watches the news for an hour at 6 o'clock every night, so they say. So they can't move that. I think I know what Dicko would say if he were here, which is that tennis is getting slower, the matches are getting longer, and that's actually the bigger problem that needs to be addressed. And I think that's probably true. Like, even some quite standard matches now take a long, long time, when really, you know, it's partly a sort of situational thing. So that's my two cents. And we've talked before, Calvin, about tennis getting slower and longer. Like, it is happening, and I think they need to wake up and realise that it's happening.
I saw a strange accusation of one of the reasons why it's getting slower earlier on, that, and again, it was, I mean, you know my position, James, we discussed it last week on the pod about allowing fans to come in whenever they want and not waiting for the change of ends. The commentators earlier, I think it was Simon Reed and Joe Jury, were saying that by doing that, you're slowing the game down because you have to stop and let them in. But I was like, why do you have to stop and let them in? They can just walk, if they can just walk in. What do we have to stop the game for? As long as they're walking in cordially and they're not making, you know, not making a big racket out of it, why do you have to wait for them all the time? US Open don't.
No, that's exactly it. And players, I've always said, players just get on with it. Right, speaking of getting on with it, let's talk about the main match of the night, Zverev versus Alcaraz. Carlos Alcaraz beaten in four sets. It looked like it would be three when Alexander Zverev served for the match just before midnight. I was ready to go home, and yet Alexander Zverev, as he has so many times in various different ways, let us all down. But he did get over the line in the end, 6-1, 6-3, 6-7. 6-4, a pretty remarkable serving performance in the first two sets. He only missed four first serves across the two first sets. Calvin, if Alexander Zverev serves like that, there is very little anyone can do about it, right?
Yeah, actually, on the way back, me and Henry were on the same flight as Lloyd Glasspool, and we were sat down having some food in the middle of the night. We were having chicken and rice at 4:30 a.m. I think, in Doha Airport, and we got into a conversation as to who the best server in the world is, and I said that it's a difficult one to judge that, because I think the best first server in the world is Alex Zverev, but his second serve is pretty gunk. But if he's serving at 85%, then doesn't matter how gunk his second serve is, because he's going to win tennis matches, or he's going to be tough to break at least.
What's the kind of mindset? I mean, it must be so difficult as a player when someone's serving like that, because you must feel under so much more pressure on your own service games.
Well, yeah, I mean, as, you know, a similar situation actually, because when Henry and Francisco lost in Melbourne to Neil Skupski and Santiago Gonzalez, those two guys served at 86% for the match, and Santi Gonzalez served at 93% himself. And the thing that you just keep saying to yourself is just stick in, because they can't continue doing this. There will be a drop, or even if in one game they drop. But in that match the other day, that doubles match, and in Zverev's match today, it didn't drop. They just kept going on. You know, that's just how it went. And that's really one of the really strange things about serving, I think. And I've thought this for many years, that when a player starts off with a certain percentage, you can kind of get it in, over the first four games, it's remarkable how that percentage tends to stay the percentage through the match. And it doesn't really waver. Just on one day, players will turn up and they're just serving at that percentage, and it just stays at that. Whereas you'd think that there'd be more up and downs, but there not often is. Especially in a five set, you'd think there'd be more up and downs, but not often is, you know. So he basically set the tone, and that's reserved that. I will say that the thing is with Zverev is that with his height, and he has quite a nice service action, you can see why he makes so many of them. That he basically just has to hit the ball down, because he can bounce it, because he's so high. He can take away the net really out of it, and he can just bounce it down. So I do think he will always have quite a high first serve percentage.
And in terms of Carlos Alcaraz, I mean, for me, and I was there at the French Open semi-final when he cramped up against Djokovic and went to pieces, I thought there were a lot of similarities between that match and this one, because he looked nervous, he looked lost, he played an atrocious first set. All right, maybe if he'd played well, Zverev still would have won, he was serving that well, but it does start to strike me that Carlos Alcaraz has got a bit of a nerves problem.
I mean, yeah, at the start, but then when he'd won the second, it looked like he was loving life. Like he was having fun, laughing with the crowd, and he really relaxed. And at that stage, I mean, we were chatting in our WhatsApp group, and I thought he was going to win it then, because I thought he just fully relaxed. And to be fair, the game that he lost his serve on, that was a concentration thing, I think. I don't think that was nerves. I think he just fully, like, I think he thought himself, I've got this now, and he just played a bad game.
So you don't think there's much to be concerned for Carlos Alcaraz?
Look, it's that one again. You know, Jim Courier always says it, that there's no experience for nerves. When it comes, it just comes, and there's nothing you can do about it. There's not, you know, he said, I remember Courier saying once that he's served for Grand Slams and not felt remotely nervous, and he's been a nervous wreck in the second round of a 250 when serving for a match. And that it really is, in my experience, both playing and in coaching, that is genuinely how it works out. I've seen very good players who I coach, great players, and that you can see they're just tight at the weirdest moments, and then at other moments they'll serve out the biggest matches they've played in. It just happens, and I don't think, having done what Carlos Alcaraz has done at his age, I don't think that we can say he has a nerves problem. I just don't.
Let's look ahead to the semi-final that today has set up then. Daniil Medvedev against Alexander Zverev. Anyone who's seen the latest season of Breakpoint on Netflix will know that these two do not get on, and that defeat for Zverev in Monte Carlo last year hit him extremely hard. The footage of him sobbing in the dressing room was particularly instructive. It's not the most mouth-watering tennis matchup, though, is it, Calvin?
No, I mean, just before I come on to that, James, just go back onto the nerves thing with Alcaraz there, and I'll say that, you know, they highlighted because of the matches, but it's basically all about two matches, I think, maybe three if you count Medvedev in the US Open, whereas if you look at the last 3 or 4 years, you can probably say that Djokovic has had that many matches where he's been overly nervous and hasn't come together. You know, you can say Wimbledon this year, you can say US Open year before last, were two matches where he basically just went to pieces. But anyway, yeah, the match Medvedev and Zverev, yeah, I think it's a weird one, isn't it? Because there is this rivalry where we know they don't like each other, but Medvedev always comes up with that Zverev thinks that they're mates, but they're not mates. I don't know if Zverev actually hates Medvedev. Medvedev can't stand Zverev. I know that, but it doesn't really seem to manifest itself in the matches, other than when Medvedev does a bit of shithousing. Like, if you know what I mean. It's like, if you didn't know that they hated each other when the matches are on, you wouldn't know at all. It's not like in the old days when McEnroe and Connors used to play each other, and it was quite obvious that they couldn't stand each other because they'd be snarking at each other the whole match. Whereas Medvedev and Zverev, they kind of just play the match, you know, as they do. Medvedev does a bit of shithousing, but he does that all the time. Zverev acts like he's Mr. Wonderful. He does that all the time. And then after the match in the press conference, they have a bit of a sniping at each other. But in the actual match, it's not like it's drama-filled because they hate each other.
And I'm going to ask you to stick your neck out for a prediction on Medvedev versus Zverev then.
I think Medvedev will beat him because he tends to beat him usually all the time. I think Zverev might have one or two wins against him, but I think Medvedev just backs himself, especially on these courts, to just beat Zverev unless it goes horribly wrong.
Yeah, they've got an 11-7 head-to-head in Medvedev's favour, but five of those came for Zverev before 2020. And since 2020, Daniil Medvedev has won all bar two, which I think probably backs up your point there. Just a quick look, in case I don't speak to you before the other semi-final, Djokovic against Sinner. It's the matchup I guess we all wanted because there are all those narrative-based matches at the end of last year. Who are you picking?
I think Djokovic will win. You've got to pick Djokovic, but I think it'll be... I'm interested to see what, you know, just how relevant those matches at the end of last year are, being that this is now in Djokovic's real arena and it's best of five. I think we might find that... I know everyone kept going, like, at the end of last year, they kept going, oh, he's won three out of three against Djokovic at the end of the year. Like, one of them was a doubles. Like, I think we might be about to find that that doubles match wasn't... And that doubles match in Davis Cup wasn't entirely relevant to how a Grand Slam semi-final is going to play out.
All right. I look forward to the thousands of words I wrote about that last year being completely irrelevant, as they usually are. Yeah. Listen, Calvin, hopefully we'll get you back as the week goes on, maybe at weird hours of the day, given your jet lag. But thanks, as always, for us having you. Thank you for listening, and come back tomorrow. Right, beautiful. Sports Social Podcast Network.